I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Crews are undertaking the complicated work of removing mangled steel and concrete at the site of the deadly collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. After a container ship lost power and crashed into a supporting column, killing six workers and throwing the Eastern U.S. transportation network into chaos. Officials say that in those murky waters, divers can't see a foot in front of them. And with all that mangled, intertwined steel above and below the water, the site is a safety risk. Here's Maryland Governor Wes Moore.
You're looking at 3,000-4,000 tons of steel that's sitting on top of the ship. And so beginning to, in sections, be able to create that pathway, create open channels, so we can actually get boats, get tugs inside the area.
And two channels have been opened near the side of the collapsed bridge to make way for smaller vessels. And as the crews continue to work, the owner of the ship filed a lawsuit on Monday, denying responsibility for the collapse and trying to limit its legal liability to $43.7 million, the current value of the ship and its cargo, in a case that credit rating agency Morningstar DBRS predicts could become the most expensive marine-insured loss in history. Joining me is Michael Sturley, a maritime law expert at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Michael, who do you anticipate will be filing lawsuits here?
The short answer is anybody who did something wrong is likely to be sued here, or anybody who can plausibly be claimed to have done something wrong is likely to be sued here.
So, of course, the victims and the families of the victims are going to sue, but what about the state or county or whoever for the cost of rebuilding the bridge, which could cost experts, say, $400 million or more?
Oh, I'd be surprised if it's that small, but I read recently that the inflation-adjusted value of the original construction was roughly twice that. Broadly speaking, you'd see claims coming from three main points. You have the property damage claims, anybody whose property was damaged as a result of this accident. Most obviously, that's going to be the owner of the bridge, which I understand is the state of Maryland. So they will certainly be suing. The federal government has indicated that it's going to be paying the rebuilding costs. So they may have subrogated claims, basically stepping into the shoes of the state of Maryland, saying, you know, we paid, you know, reimburse us for what we paid for your damage. There will probably be minor property damage claims. You know, whatever vehicles ended up in the water, you know, their owners will have property damage claims, you know, relatively minor in the scheme of things. Then the second broad category you have is the personal injury claims. There were at least two workers who went into the water who survived, and then you had the six workers who went into the water tragically did not survive. So there'll be wrongful death claims from the families of the decedents, and there will presumably be personal injury claims from the two people who survived. There may be other people who claim negligent infliction of emotional distress, who were in the zone of danger and suffered mental harm. So broad class of personal injury claimants. Typically, these disasters tend to attract what are called economic loss claimants, people who claim that they have suffered economic loss as a result of this disaster. Typically, those claims do not succeed unless the person also suffered some physical injury, property damage. So, for example, the state could recover for the economic loss in not collecting bridge tolls for the next however many years it takes to rebuild the bridge. Because they suffered property damage, they can also recover for their economic loss. But if you have businesses who say, I'm getting less business because people can't cross the bridge to get to my business, you know, they're going somewhere else because now they're going through the tunnel, but they didn't suffer any damage, any physical damage, those claims are typically dismissed under maritime law. How many people will be in those three categories? I don't have enough information, but the eight workers and the bridge owner are certainly going to be the obvious claims. You know, it looks like those will be the big money amounts.
So- So the owner of the ship is trying to limit liability to about $42.7 million. And they claim that the collapse of the bridge was not due to any fault, neglect, or want of care of the companies. And they shouldn't be held liable, first of all. And if they are held liable, then it shouldn't be for more than the current value of the ship and cargo. This is a common move by ship owners after catastrophic crashes, isn't it? Tell us about that obscure, I'd say obscure for most of us, law from 1851 that involves the Titanic.
Well, I mean, 1851 was obviously, 60-some years before the Titanic, although the law was famously invoked in the Titanic case. So Congress passed the statute in 1851, designed to encourage investment in shipping. Middle of the 19th century was before the era when the corporate form became common. So it was designed for an era when individuals and partnerships generally owned vessels. And the idea was that if an individual risked all of their assets by investing in a ship, that made it a less appealing investment. I mean, you can imagine today that if all of the shareholders of BP had to chip in to pay for the cost of the BP oil spill in the Gulf, you know, that would make people less willing to invest in companies that face those kinds of risks. Now, the corporate form obviously takes away that risk. You know, if you buy shares in BP, the value of your share is at risk, but worst case scenario is your share value goes down to nothing. You know, the company goes into liquidation, but the rest of your assets are not subject to those claims. And what the 1851 Limitation Act essentially does is treat every ship as though it were an individual corporation. So if you can imagine, you know, suppose that this ship owner, instead of owning this ship and other assets as well, owned nothing but the ship. And then the ship is in a terrible accident, takes out a bridge, facing massive lawsuits. If the ship were in fact a single corporation, the corporation would declare bankruptcy, say that our only asset is the ship, you know, total value, you know, $40 million, liquidate the corporation, take our assets and distribute them pro rata among the claimants. Shareholders lose the value of their investment, but that's the extent of it. Essentially, what the Limitation Act does is the same thing. It says even though the ship owner owns other assets, they will be allowed to limit its liability under certain circumstances to the value of the asset involved in the accident. Now, as you say, this is very common. I previously predicted that the chances of a limitation action being filed here were somewhere north of 99.99%. It didn't take long for that prediction to be justified. Ship owners, you know, routinely do this. And they routinely do it even in circumstances where they know they don't qualify for limitation. You know, if you look at the BP oil spill again. You know, Transocean was the owner of the vessel there. They filed a limitation petition. The district court held they were not entitled to limit their liability, but Transocean still got a major benefit out of doing that. You look at the El Faro disaster. The vessel owner there filed a limitation proceeding. Again, they were held not entitled to limitation, but they still got a benefit. What the limitation action does is centralize all the litigation in one court. Now, here we've got the bridge owner, 8 personal injury claimants. So we've got at least 9 obvious claimants. But for the limitation proceeding, they could possibly file in 9 different courts. And very likely they might be filing in state court. You know, the state of Maryland may well prefer to sue in its own courts rather than going to federal court. Personal injury lawyers often prefer state court over federal court. And depending on where the 8 workers live, they may file in 8 different state courts. So the vessel owner would be in the position of having to defend, you know, 9 different suits, but all arising out of the same incident, all involving the same facts in 9 different forms. And, you know, having to go through everything 9 different times and having the risk of inconsistent results. By filing this petition, all of the litigation is channeled into the Federal District Court for the District of Maryland. If you read the petition, it inevitably includes the boilerplate provision asking the court to require all claims to be filed in that court and enjoining litigation anywhere else. So even if they don't get limitations, the vessel owner at least gets the benefit of, at least for the time being, having everything in this one court. And what's more, in one court sitting in admiralty, which generally means no jury.
What would plaintiffs have to do in order to overcome that liability limit? What do they have to show?
They have to show basically that the owner was at fault. You know, the statutory language is the fault or knowledge of the owner, I think. there are several limitation provisions in maritime law that use somewhat different language, fault or privity, fault or knowledge. I think fault or knowledge is the language in this statute. So they have to show that the owner did something wrong. Now, what's a bit unusual, a bit counterintuitive there, is that they have to show the personal fault of the owner. And of course, the owner is a corporation. The corporation acts only through its agents. But the way the law has been developed, they have to show the fault of basically senior management. They have to show that shoreside management is at fault here, not simply that people on board the vessel did something wrong.
What about mechanical failure?
Well, mechanical failure could be a latent defect that the owner is not at fault for, or it could be the result of a failure to maintain the vessel properly, which the owner is at fault for. You know, often when a ship loses power, it's some problem with the bunker fuel. Now, if it's a problem with the bunker fuel, the owner is going to bring in the bunker fuel supplier and say, it's your fault that this happened. But the claimants are certainly going to say to the owner, you know, you should have taken better care to make sure you got good bunker fuel. And then there'll be a fight about whether or not the owner was responsible for that.
Is it a difficult hurdle for plaintiffs to overcome this liability limit?
Most limitation actions result in limitation not being granted. So most limitations, and vessel owners know this, they still file the limitation claims to get the benefit of the concursus, to get the benefit of having all of the claims filed in the same court. Even if they don't get limitation, they still get a major benefit from the concursus. In most cases, the court finds that the owner did something wrong that could have avoided the accident. You know, the owner's management did something wrong, and therefore they're not entitled to limit liability. Whether that happens here is going to depend on what the facts are. I certainly don't know enough of the facts, and I suspect nobody yet knows enough of the facts to know how that's going to play out. But the process will continue, and the court will figure out whether or not the owner did something wrong here.
Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, I'll continue this conversation with Michael Sturley of the University of Texas at Austin School of Law, and we'll talk about the insurance coverage. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Two channels with different depths have been opened near the site of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore Harbor to make way for smaller vessels. During a briefing today, authorities said the weather was hindering the work. Brigadier General John Lloyd said the divers are working in low visibility and hazardous conditions on the bridge wreckage.
The same complexity and challenges, even more so, are below the water as well. And I think that's what's going to make it such a challenge in removing this wreckage. It's not only what you see above the water, but below the water as well.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg has said there's no timeline for reopening the busy port of Baltimore because of the complexity of the work.
It's not just that you have to remove the wreckage. It's that you have to do it in a way that doesn't cause portions of the bridge that are there across the water to shift. They've been under a lot of compression and tension. They could behave almost like a spring if they are not expertly managed.
As the recovery continues and parts of the ship remain stuck at the site of the accident, the owner of the ship that rammed into the bridge is seeking to limit its liability for the accident. The company, Grace Ocean, filed a lawsuit in federal court on Monday, claiming the collapse of the bridge was not due to any fault, neglect, or want of care, and that it shouldn't be held liable for any loss or damage from the disaster. But if it is held liable, it shouldn't be for more than the current value of the ship and its cargo. I've been talking to maritime law expert Michael Sturley of the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. So Bloomberg Intelligence reports that the ship alone has about $3 billion of reinsurance coverage. Just generally, does reinsurance kick in? Does it cover the costs if the owner's suit for limited liability fails?
Well, there are two kinds of insurance that are relevant here. A number of news agencies have been reporting that the ship had only, I think it was $90 million of insurance. That's talking about its hull and machinery insurance, which is a kind of property insurance. That's the insurance that the vessel owner has to reimburse it if the vessel is lost or damaged. And the vessel owner is citing that in the limitation petition to show what the value of the ship is, which is relevant to the limitation proceeding. The insurance that you're talking about is liability insurance, which is probably the more important insurance here. And that's the insurance that the vessel owner has to cover its liabilities if it's found liable to a third party. And typically in a case like this, the vessel will be entered in what's known as a P&I club, which is basically a kind of mutual insurance company where vessel owners get together and pool their risks. I've read the news reports that this vessel was entered with Britannia, one of the major P&I clubs. And typically the vessel owner will have a certain retention amount, what most people would think of as a deductible. So the vessel owner will be responsible for the first, you know, some level. I don't know what it's individually negotiated for each case. Say the first $10 million will be the vessel owner's responsibility. Then the P&I club will pick up the next, you know, whatever the club has arranged. And then beyond that, you go into reinsurance. There are about a dozen P&I clubs in the world, the International Group of P&I Clubs, and they pool the risk among themselves. And then beyond that, they go into reinsurance in the secondary market. If the vessel owner is allowed to limit its liability, then the vessel owner and its P&I club will be able to avoid taking advantage of that. If they're not entitled to limit liability, then you've got a big insurance fund that's going to cover a lot of the losses here. One point to make, though, the limitation by its terms permits the vessel owner to limit its liability. That has been interpreted to allow both the vessel owner and what's known as a bareboat charterer to limit its liability. A bareboat charterer is someone who doesn't actually own the vessel but operates as though they were the owner. Sometimes throw in some Latin here, call them the owner pro hoc vice. I mean, if you think about it in a more familiar consumer context, you know, if you buy a car, obviously it's your car, you know, you own it. But if you lease your car, say you get a 3-year lease, technically you don't own the car, but you act like you own the car. It's, you know, for all intents and purposes, you are operating it as though you own the car. That's essentially what a bareboat charter is, that you have leased the vessel for a fixed time period, but you operate it. You do all of the, you know, you hire the crew, you arrange provisions, you make all the decisions, you run it like you own it. So the Limitation Act protects the owner and that bareboat charterer. This limitation petition claims limitation on behalf of both the owner and the vessel manager. I will be very curious to see whether the court allows the vessel manager to limit liability. That's not an obvious beneficiary of the Limitation Act. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Until I started doing research, I didn't realize how many maritime accidents there have been in recent years. A dive boat caught fire off the coast of Southern California in 2019 and killed 34 people. So the litigation has not yet been resolved there. So are we anticipating this is going to take years and years and years?
I don't know how long it's going to take to resolve the Conception Fire case, but yes, there is a lot of litigation going on there. The Conception Fire actually prompted Congress to amend the Limitation Act for one of the very few times in its history. You know, the statute was amended after the Titanic. For the most part, it hasn't changed a whole lot since 1851. But in December 22, I think it was, Congress had a very minor amendment to exclude what are called covered small passenger vessels from the scope of the Limitation Act, basically to say that the next time that a disaster like the Conception happens, the vessel owner can't claim the benefit of limitation. So every once in a while, Congress does respond to very high-profile accidents with amendments to the Limitation Act.
And so the cases involving this bridge collapse will take years and years?
I would be surprised if this is resolved quickly, but you never know. I mean, most cases, in fact, settle. So as we learn more about the accident, as the parties learn more about the accident, if it becomes obvious that the vessel owner did something wrong and is at fault and won't be allowed to limit liability, then a settlement may happen more quickly. I wouldn't be surprised if the personal injury claimants end up settling fairly quickly, even if the litigation overpaying for the replacement of the bridge goes on much longer. You know, in the BP oil spill case, for example, there were 11 Transocean workers, employees who were killed in the accident. Those cases settled very quickly. Transocean took care of its employees. That didn't need to go into extended litigation. You know, the big fight was over who was going to pay for the cleanup costs, not the personal injury claims.
I have to say, this is a whole different legal area for me. I appreciate your insights. That's Michael Sturley of the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, this year's congressional elections in South Carolina will be held under a map that a panel of three judges had ruled was unconstitutional and discriminatory against black voters. Why? Because the Supreme Court hasn't issued a decision in the case, despite the fact that oral arguments took place back in October. In other legal news today, Donald Trump has sued two co-founders of his newly public Trump Media and Technology Group, claiming they set the company up improperly and shouldn't get any stock in it. It's the latest legal skirmish over who gets how much of the hot but flailing meme stock. Trump alleges that the two violated an agreement about the setup and don't deserve their 8.6% stake, currently valued at $606 million. The lawsuit, which was filed on March 24th in Florida State Court, comes after the pair brought their own suit against the former president in Delaware Chancery Court over their promised stake in the social media company. The legal fight is playing out amid wild swings in shares of Trump Media, which began trading last week after it merged with a special purpose acquisition company known as a SPAC. The stock dropped 21% on Monday after Trump Media disclosed in a securities filing a $58 million loss and a relative trickle of revenue for 2023, and reiterated a warning that it needed the money from the SPAC deal to keep operating. The judge in Delaware said he was gobsmacked to learn of Trump's Florida suit, which he filed instead of bringing counterclaims against the duo in his Delaware courtroom. He also said he'd consider possible sanctions against the former president in the Delaware case. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This year's congressional elections in South Carolina will be held under a map that a panel of federal judges found was unconstitutional and discriminatory against black voters. The case is in the hands of the Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments last October. With no decision from the high court, the failure of Republican legislators to redraw the map, and time running out ahead of voter deadlines, a federal court ruled that the unconstitutional map will be used. Joining me is elections law expert Richard Brafault, a professor at Columbia Law School. Rich, tell us about the history of this case.
Following the 2020 census, the Republican legislature of South Carolina redistricted. They didn't need to change the number of seats, but they moved some around in order to improve the prospects for Republican. Actually, it's Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who represents the District 1 near Charleston. And what they did is they basically made her district more Republican and an adjacent district more Democratic. In so doing, they moved a significant number of black voters from her district to the adjacent district, District 6. That led to a lawsuit that this was a form of racial gerrymandering, that the voters were being moved because of their race. That lawsuit was brought, and the plaintiffs won that case before a three-judge court in early 2023. The judge directed the legislature to redistrict. The legislature has been resisting that ever since and has taken appeals, and the case was actually argued before the Supreme Court in October, 6 months ago now. The Supreme Court has yet to rule on South Carolina's appeal. Many thought that that would be decided much earlier since they heard the case fairly early in the term. With the legislature not having redistricted, and this case having been sitting in the Supreme Court now for quite some time, the three-judge court basically decided it's too late. The period for people filing to become candidates in the primary had already opened. In fact, I think it's already closed by now. There's soon going to be a deadline sometime in April for sending out military and overseas ballots. And the court basically said, although the ideal would be to go for, because they did hold the current lines unlawful going back to the start of 2023, they said, and given the fact that the litigation hasn't been resolved to the Supreme Court, the legislature hasn't done anything yet, it's too late for this year. So although we don't like it, we are going to allow the elections to go forward under the old rules that the court had said were unconstitutional as a racial gerrymander.
So the court said they're going to now use the maps that were declared unconstitutional. Is there anything else this court could have done to avoid that?
Well, I guess they could have appointed a special master and actually drawn the lines themselves. I think their feeling was, you know, we will know eventually from the Supreme Court whether these are good lines or not. And it is beginning to get close to the election. And I think the problem is the case began wending its way to the Supreme Court about a year ago. They actually had that oral argument, as I said, 6 months ago. It's just taken a huge amount of time to move forward, and no one really quite understands why it's been delayed so long in the Supreme Court, especially since I think many observers felt that South Carolina actually did reasonably well in the oral argument. It's hard to tell whether the Supreme Court's going to affirm the lower court decision or not. But in any event, the state has effectively won, at least for this year. Even if the Supreme Court affirms the court and agrees that the lines are unconstitutional, those lines are going to be used for the 2024 election.
Both the state and the civil rights groups who were challenging the map had asked the Supreme Court to issue a decision by January 1st so they could prepare for the upcoming elections. Is this the first time, or have there been other times when the Supreme Court has not been acting particularly fast and has allowed maps that have been declared unconstitutional to be used?
Well, I think that's what happened actually with the Alabama litigation, where the Supreme Court stayed a lower court decision holding a plan violates the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court stayed that, and then more than a year later finally actually decided the case and actually said that the lower court had been correct. And at that point, the map was changed. But in the meantime, an election had been held under the map, which the lower court had felt was illegal, but the Supreme Court had stayed for a considerable period of time so that they could decide the case. So that affected the 2022 election.
It just boggles the mind that in a case like this, they can't get a decision out. Although, I mean, the Supreme Court has been handing out decisions more slowly as of late.
This does seem to have been one of the slowest years. The people who keep track of this have said that they got off to the slowest start of any year in a very long time, and they've still issued relatively few opinions.
So we had the Alabama case where the court came out with a ruling that was favorable to the challengers. But yet, as you say, in the oral arguments, it seemed like it was going against the challengers in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Explain the difference between the two cases.
The issue in this case really has more to do with how do you disentangle racial gerrymandering from partisan gerrymandering. Kind of the central issue in this case is the Republican legislature in South Carolina is happy to say that what they did was a partisan gerrymander, because given the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago, partisan gerrymandering cannot be challenged. It's non-justiciable. It's not unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court, but racial gerrymandering is. And often the two are closely connected. If you're moving a big block of black voters who happen to be Democrats or Democratic voters who happen to be black, there is a debate as to what exactly the state is doing. The lower court here concluded that based on a variety of factors, it was better characterized as a racial gerrymander. The issue in Alabama was differently complicated in that there the state was using a basic configuration of how to draw districts in the state that they'd been using for some time. They made just minor changes from one census to the next, but was not a conscious or an obvious effort in the 2020 redistricting. But the plaintiffs were able to show that the districting structure that the state had been using for several decades discriminated against black voters because of the way the districts were drawn. And although you couldn't show that the state intended to do this, they were able to present alternative maps which were just as straightforward, you know, no more convoluted, no more, you know, odd shapes than the maps being used, which would provide fairer representation for black voters. So that case is very much about what does fair representation require for minority voters. And this case was really about whether or not the discrimination going on here was racial or partisan.
So this ruling came a day after a different federal court upheld a congressional map in Florida that favors Republicans and erases a seat held by a black Democrat. Just explain what happened there.
Again, I think it was a similar question of whether or not this was race or party, and they concluded it was party. And when it's party, it's, you know, this may sound really weird to people. First, the whole idea of race versus party, that they're different and that they can be disentangled, but that partisan gerrymandering can't be challenged and racial gerrymandering can be. And so much turns on how you're going to characterize what exactly happened. And, you know, those can be hard questions as to whether or not it's race or party, also, given that they're often connected.
Often it seems like they're inextricable. Yeah. But so also on Thursday, a federal appeals court issued a ruling that all but ensures North Carolina will use state legislative maps this fall that have been challenged?
They basically, again, decided, following a lower court decision, that they would not block the maps. Those were maps that were adopted by the Republican legislature in the fall, and a Voting Rights Act claim was brought. And I think in some ways what's happened is that they basically decided they wouldn't block it for now. Again, some of these things come up on motions for injunctions. In other words, given that the election is coming soon, the plaintiffs want to stop the new law from taking effect and then hold the trial. And the state is saying, well, no, the law can go into effect. You can have the trial later. Then we can change it later if you find it's unlawful.
And voting rights advocates say that's too late because you can't change the vote.
There is this thing known as the Purcell principle, the idea that you shouldn't be changing the rules governing an election too close to the election. No one knows when is it too close to an election, but we're probably beginning to get there, at least for primaries. Even if some of the earlier action in a case may have taken place months ago. You know, I think in this case, in the North Carolina case, there was a decision going back to January of 23. It just took, you know, a long time for it to kind of percolate through the system.
Are states here basically trying to run out the clock?
I think they often do. I mean, they often basically say, well, no preliminary injunction, no emergency motions, please. And then as they continue to bring appeals, that will delay things. There may eventually be a trial, and then there may eventually be an appeal of the trial, and the appeal may actually get decided. And that's kind of what happened in Alabama. But just sometimes they do seem to be stretching it all out in delay and delay and delay.
So these decisions, along with others in recent months, does that mean that the congressional maps for 2024 are largely set?
I think that's right. I think that the litigation is now just about done. We are into April. Many states have already had their primaries. I think there are probably no primaries later than June, or at least not many. I think we're getting very late in the season, and we're probably done.
I want to get your reaction to a political article that said that Republicans came out ahead in the battle to control the House in 2024 thanks to the redistricting aggression of North Carolina Republicans and the timidity of New York Democrats.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I may be a little defensive of the New York Democrats. They had a tough situation. But yes, North Carolina did a very sharp gerrymander and basically moved three seats from the Democratic column to the Republican column, which is huge. The problem in New York is that New York does have this independent redistricting commission and this redistricting process that the state adopted in the 2010s and which was used for the first time in 2022. And the state failed to do it right, according to the New York State's highest court, leading to the appointment of a special master who came up with a plan that was fairly favorable to Republicans. The Democrats got a second shot at this by persuading the Court of Appeals that they had a right to try again, but I think they were kind of gun-shy based on what happened the first time, and they did not want to make an aggressive move to seriously change what was done in 2022. So they tinkered, and my understanding from the more political people is probably, most they might have affected the outcome in one district. Mostly it seems to me that they were kind of protecting Democrats who were in vulnerable districts and may have recalculated one of the districts that which went narrowly Republican last time in a way that makes it even more truly even. But it seems as though it's, you know, that based on redistricting, it's not clear there would be any Democratic pickups in New York, or at most one. At one point, Democrats were thinking optimistically there could be three, four, or five. So there was definitely a loss of three seats in North Carolina. Not clear that there was any gain in New York. Alabama was probably a pickup because of the redistricting there. Again, so if we're just talking about maps, I think the remapping was marginally pro-Republican.
Adam Kincaid, the executive director of the National Republican Redistricting Trust, told Politico, it's a marginally more favorable map in 24 than we even had in 22.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. Now, of course, 22 was an election where many people thought the Republicans were going to do really well. And although they did take the House, they took it much more narrowly than had been predicted. Much will turn on, of course, the presidential election. You know, we're still 6 months out from that or more. So no one knows how that's going to go. And turnout is often different in presidential election years than in off years. So the Republicans, I think, were hoping for a lot. In 22, they won, but they won more narrowly than people had expected. They may be slightly better off now, but the presidential election will matter for a lot. And maybe the kind of the messiness of the Republican Congress will matter for something, too.
It's going to be a long 7 months, that's for sure. Thanks so much, Rich. That's Professor Richard Brafault of Columbia Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg. Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.